So thank you very much. It's always interesting hearing yourself being introduced. You think, oh, she sounds quite interesting. Such indeed is he, the richly endowed, the free, the fully and perfectly awake, equipped with knowledge and practice, the happily attained, knower of the worlds, guide unsurpassed of humans to be tamed, the teacher of gods and people, the awakened one richly endowed. All my life I go for refuge to the awakened one. To all the awakened of the past, to all the awakened yet to be, to all the awakened that now are, my worship flows unceasingly. No other refuge than the wake, refuge supreme is there for me, oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory. So I could just leave it there. That could be the talk about Buddha Day, but I won't, I'll talk for a bit longer. So thank you very much for inviting me to give a talk. It's been a while actually since I've been at the LBC. I used to come here a lot, and I don't know how many talks I've given in this very room. It's always a bit, I can never see quite who's in front. They need to get a smaller podium, or I need to grow a bit for next time. Anyway, so I was very delighted to be invited to come, and thank you for that. I do still have a sense of feeling a bit like home, the LBC, even though I don't come that often. But I was here for quite, 12 of its formative years, really. So it's very close to my heart. Anyway, it's Buddha Day, or at least today's Buddha Day's been celebrated in the Buddha Day festival. I think the full moon's actually through the week sometime. I can't remember which day. So this time last year, I was also given a Buddha Day talk, but I was given a Buddha Day talk in Eastbourne, with a slightly smaller group of people, but equally enthusiastic. And just before I gave the talk, I'd gone for a walk, and it was really windy and blustery. So it was quite kind of invigorating just before I gave the talk. I mean, I know Eastbourne doesn't seem very invigorating. Somebody suggested to me recently I could retire there. I'm planning to retire in about a year and a half from being order convener. So I'm getting all these offers from people at the moment. Somebody said, oh, you could come to Eastbourne. And I was like, why would I do that? It's full of pensioners. And they said, well, you'll be a pensioner. And I thought, it's true. I still think I'm 19. Anyway, walking by that sea, I was just struck by how deeply the elements and landscape affect her, or at least affect my mental state. I find I'm very sort of, the sunshine comes out and I'm like, oh, it's a lovely day. And when it's rainy, I'm a bit more, you know, I notice in some ways it's a bit embarrassing how much I'm affected by landscape and elements. I was thinking of wind landscape, which really has affected me in my life, and you almost recreated it here, which is Bodh Gaya. So this talk is kind of called Under the Bodhi Tree. So to imagine that you're under the Bodhi Tree in Bodh Gaya, or Buddha Gaya. So I'd never been to Buddha Gaya. I'd been to India quite often, but only ever to Maharashtra until 2009, when we held an international order convention for members of the Tri Ratna order. Well, in fact, at that time, we weren't Tri Ratna. We were still the Western Buddhist order. Anyway, we went there, and then we had another one in 2013. So I'm not sure if any of the order members here were at. I think Nyanavacha was there, weren't you? And Parma Bandhu was certainly there in 2013 because he gave a talk then. Vandana Jyoti was at one, if not both of them. You were around, yeah. Anyway, it was an amazing experience. I mean, it was a peak experience for me being at Bodh Gaya for an order convention. Something about this, the two things coming together, the kind of tradition where the Buddha, we're told where the Buddha gained enlightenment, the tree that he sat under, or a descendant of the tree that he sat under, and my community, as it were, you know, the community of the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. It was an extraordinary experience. There were about, I think on that one, there were about 500 of us in the second one. And maybe a little bit less than that, but about 300 members of our order from India and couple of hundred from outside India. And that might not sound very radical, but actually it is quite extraordinary. It was absolutely amazing sitting there under the Bodhi tree. And all these, you know, have any of you been to Buddha Gaya? You know, it's like full of all sorts of people doing the Tibetan chanting up there and the Hinayana, Theravadan chanting down there. And it's just the big kind of sogan on at the same time. And people couldn't take their eyes off us. I couldn't quite figure out who we were. You know, we were doing chanting like the Tiratnavandana, which is what I read from at the beginning of this. We were chanting Padmasambhava mantras. We were chanting all sorts of things. I think people really struggled to place us in that sort of situation. And we had quite a lot of Tibetan monks joining in with the Padmasambhava mantra, which was great fun. But for me, one of the things that really spoke to me about the radical nature of the Buddhist community and the radical nature of our community was one morning, well, over the 5 days or so we were there, in the mornings, an Indian Dharmacharini called Jnanashuri was leading the morning meditations. And that's quite extraordinary. This is a woman who's from the Dalit class. She's, you know, started her life in that way. She was actually at the conversions as a small child. She was at the conversion experience when Dr. Ambedkar took refuge and became a Buddhist. If this doesn't make much sense to you, don't worry, you can ask some of the org members and they'll tell you all about it. But anyway, it was something about, she's an Indian woman of particular caste, particular background, leading this community, which was full of men and women, Indian and non-Indians, and that's really quite something. And I just loved that. I still find it when I think of it, very sort of, it really makes me feel quite emotional, just how important that is, that in some ways we've been able to create a community where that can happen. And that comes all the way from the Buddha 2,500 years ago and more. And there we were, sitting under the Bodhi tree, being able to kind of really rejoice in our diversity and really rejoice in our kind of thriving community. So, and actually what I found quite interesting was I felt this incredible devotion to the tree. Actually sort of, you know, people say, oh, how did it feel to step on the ground that the Buddha stepped on? And actually I didn't quite get that. But there was something about this tree, this magnificent banyan tree just spreading there. You know, it's all these people for over these years that have just been there and sat there and just really wanted to kind of devote themselves to the same path that the Buddha devoted himself to. So I felt very sort of touched and expanded by being in that situation. So what I want to do really is talk a bit about the lead-up and the experience of the Buddha's enlightenment. So you've probably heard about this through the day already, and I'm sure most of you probably know the story as well as I do, or you know, many of you will, but I'm sure you won't mind being reminded and hopefully put in a particular mood. So you'll recall that Siddhartha, as a young man, very sort of privileged background, decides he needs to leave home and go forth to look for a spiritual awakening. And we're told that this happens because he saw four sights. So we don't really know whether he literally had never in his life ever seen a sick person, an old person, a corpse, and then a wandering monk. I mean, it's hard to imagine that he'd managed to reach whatever age. What age was he? 29, thank you. A bit of audience participation, it's good. But it's hard to imagine that he'd reached 29 such a sheltered way that he'd never seen an old person. I mean, what did they do with them? You know, so as soon as they reached pensionable age, stuck them in a room somewhere. And presumably he'd seen sick people before, and presumably maybe he hadn't seen a corpse. You can get to 29 apparently without seeing a corpse. But I guess what it means is that these things suddenly dawned upon him. And I imagine we've all had that experience of we know impermanence, we know things are as they are, but you kind of know it, but it just passes you by, really. And then for some reason, something really impacts, and it's as though you've seen it for the first time. Maybe because somebody close to you dies or is ill, or who knows? I mean, sometimes it's a surprising thing that can really hit home and you think, God, you know, what am I doing with my life? And I'm sure everybody in this room has had that experience, because you probably wouldn't be here otherwise. Well, maybe there's one or two people that haven't had that experience yet. But generally speaking, when you get to a certain age, you're going to have had that kind of experience to get you here. And there's something about when things stop being abstract, when they actually start hitting home and you think, oh, I look just like my mother looked. Or, you know, I've got my hair's not actually the jet black curly mass that it was a few years ago. So something kind of actually hits you, doesn't it? And what hit Siddhartha at that moment was that suffering happens. Dukkha hit him. He was struck by the fact that the very fact that we're humans, the very fact that we're born into the human family, means that certain things will follow. That if we're lucky, we'll reach an old age and that will bring its own things. And I can assure you it does. You start noticing, you know, your memory's not quite as sharp as it used to be and creak a bit. Well, there's a great Leonard Cohen song that says, what is it, that line? I ache in the places where I used to play. Such a good line. Wish I'd thought of that one. But I distracted myself there with Leonard Cohen. See what I mean? I'm just doing this to show you what a senior moment might look like. So yeah, we realise that suffering affects all beings. Siddhartha realised that actually, as soon as you're born, the one sure thing is that you will die. You might not know when, you might not know how, but you can be pretty sure that that's what's happening. And he actually has a memory of, at that point, he has a memory of these little creatures being churned up when his father's ploughman is ploughing through the earth at some point. And he sees how all these creatures are just thrown up and their homes are wrecked. Do any of you know the Robert Burns poem, To a Mouse? Kelly Navatcha does. Anyway, there's a bit in that where the wee mousey's house just gets thrown to the winds. It's where the famous line, the best laid plans of mice and men, comes from. Whatever we do, you can make all the plans you like, but fate comes along, or whatever it is, life comes along and churns you up. So he remembers that and he realises that he really wants to find a way out of suffering. And he wants to find it not just for himself, but for all beings. So he leaves home. And, you know, if you heard from The Light of Asia today, you'll have heard that bit, I imagine, where he gets his charioteer and they leave. He cuts his hair, he puts on the rags, and he just goes off. And that sense of going forth is very evocative. It's a very kind of poignant moment, because in the way it's written and the way it's portrayed, Sir Edwin Arnold portrays it in that translation, is like, you know, he's looking back and he's seeing all that he loves. And it must be very tempting just to kind of move back towards that comfort, love of a certain kind of, you know, a family, etc., etc. He really wants that. But he sees that they're also subject to suffering. So he wants to move, he wants to go forth so that he can find a way out of that suffering for them as much as for him and for all beings. So he takes off. He practices for 6 years. He practices all sorts of strange, weird and wonderful practices, asceticisms of all natures, which are quite fun actually if you read about them, big long list of all these strange things that he does. And he makes progress, but he's not satisfied, and he keeps going to different teachers, and he keeps getting, he learns everything that they can teach him, and he surpasses them, and then he thinks, what next? What next? I always think that's quite an interesting thing, that, you know, he could have stayed famous at any of those levels, but actually the push, the drive to kind of break through and find the real response to suffering was so strong that he just keeps moving ahead and moving forward. So he also remembers another experience from his youth. It's known as the rose apple tree experience. So he remembers as a child sitting under a rose apple tree in his in his father's land. And it's, I imagine, a beautiful, warm, afternoon, if there's ploughing happening, you can probably smell the earth churning and get that real sense of being part of nature. And he's just filled with this extraordinary sense of peace. And he realises when he remembers that, that all these ascetic practices that he's doing are not leading him to that place of peace. So he decides, to the great disgust of his companions, to have some milk and some rice and to actually just sit under this tree. And he says he's going to sit there until enlightenment arises. So incredible determination. So I'm just going to read to you from, it's probably from the Anguttara Nikaya. No, the Majjhima Nikaya. Anyway, this is a little bit of a reading of what happens when he makes that decision. Now, when I had eaten solid food and regained strength, quite secluded from sensual desire, from unprofitable things, I entered upon and abode in meditation. Meditation which is accompanied by thinking and exploring with happiness and pleasure. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling to gain power over my mind. With the stilling of thinking and exploring, I entered upon another meditation stage, which has internal confidence and singleness of mind. It goes on and he describes these different stages of meditation that he passes through. When my concentrated mind was purified, bright, unblemished and rid of imperfection, steady and attained to imperturbability, I inclined my mind to knowledge of recollection of my past lives. I reflected and I recollected my manifold past life through one birth, two, three, four, five, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100. I remembered I was so named there, I was of such a race, such an experience, such food, such experiences of pleasure and pain, etc., etc. Thus, with details and particulars, I recollected these past lives. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I inclined my mind to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of creatures. I understood how all creatures arise and pass according to their actions. This was the second true knowledge attained by me. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. So, this, of course, is a retrospective explanation of the experience that happened. You know, one can only imagine he did not sit there thinking, oh, and now I will just recollect this. So it seems, if one can understand and really try and enter into this, that it was experiential, that he experienced, whatever that might mean, he experienced the arising and the passing of all conditions. He knew with every fibre of his being that there was nothing within him that was fixed, eternal, unchanging. There was nothing within him that was substantial, that could be held onto. He saw that he had arisen through conditions, and that as those conditions changed, then he too changed. And this meant he broke free. He was fully liberated. And I love to think of that as the translation of enlightenment. Liberation, the breaking free of the bonds that hold us to a smaller sense of self. So we have these words and concepts, but they're only to help push us towards an experience. They're only, as they say in Zen, the finger pointing to the moon. They're not actually in themselves the real thing. They're pointing to an experience. And interesting, that experience was all about the rising and passing of phenomena. And in the first watch, he saw through that in terms of his own life. So why do we take it literally that he saw that he'd been so-and-so in such a place and stuff like that? Why do we take that literally and know in a way is, you know, it's up to you in a sense. Can take it, how I've always understood it, is that he really experienced that whatever way he took form, that there was an arising and a passing, that that was the important thing, that law of conditionality. But then in the second watch, he saw that this was not a purely personal thing. And I think what that's pointing to is that it wasn't linear. So it wasn't that he, Siddhartha, had been this person and then the next person and the next person kind of through time, because he saw that all creatures arise and pass in a dependence upon conditions. And he presumably saw that he arose in dependence upon the same conditions through which others arose. That in some ways what he saw through there, presumably, and experienced, was the known separation of the process that had given rise to him and the process itself, the process of life arising and passing. So he saw that law applied to all conditioned existence, and he freed himself from all taints of ego clinging. And it's interesting that in this text it says he didn't allow the pleasant feelings to kind of take him away. Again, that must have been quite tempting. You know, I'm sure, as we all know, as we soar through those wonderful meditative experiences that we all have every time we sit on a cushion. And it's so tempting to remain in those meditative states. But of course we know that, you know, there is more to it than that. There's more to life than bliss. So the Buddha is now awakened. So what does he do? Well, initially he doesn't do anything. And that in itself is also quite interesting. We're told that he remains for 7 weeks. Now, again, is that a literal time? Did somebody mark it down? You know, how long he sat there? But what we do know is that he didn't just jump up and move on to the next experience, that he actually sat and assimilated that. He didn't immediately rush off. And we do need those absorption periods in our life. When we're practicing, to whatever extent we're practicing, we will find ourselves getting in touch with parts of ourselves maybe that we didn't quite expect to meet. And sometimes we really need to be able to have a little bit of space around that and just allow that to be assimilated. You know, it is shocking in a way how fast life happens these days. Even I've noticed it in my lifetime that, you know, somebody said that the 20th century was the fastest century in history, where things became better and better and worse at a faster rate than ever before. I suspect it's probably true. And things do move so quickly, you know. It's like sometimes it's just very tempting to move on to the next thing. So we need, when we have the bliss of emancipation in our life, we need to give it space. We need to really allow that to be absorbed. And we all know what that feels like. I'm sure all of us have had the experience of feeling free suddenly from something that's trapped us. So when I was down in Eastbourne last year and I was walking through the wind, having this blustery day, there was a moment where it was getting quite wild and there was a wall, and I just stepped behind the wall and I was out of the wind. And it's just such an extraordinary difference to be battered around by the wind and then not in the wind. I had a solitary retreat in one of the Orkney Isles a few years back, and the Orkney Isles do wind. Wind is a speciality of the Orkney Isles. There's no trees, so if a wind comes, it comes. And I just arrived, and the next morning I went out for a walk and discovered later that there had been 70 mile an hour winds that day. So I was, you know, you're walking into it, and then when you're walking back, it's, you kind of walk really fast because there's this 70 mile an hour wind behind you. And again, I had the same experience of stepping behind a wall and suddenly there's no wind. And it always makes me think that must be what it's like when the worldly winds die down and true emancipation arises. So we can get, what a sense of relief that is, yeah, when we can break through the things that trap us. And we're told that the Buddha sat like a mountain, touched but untouched by clouds. So if you imagine clouds hitting a mountain, they don't have a big effect. They just carry on. So the Buddha just sat there. So we know that the Buddha, this newly enlightened being, was a peaceful being. There was peace. Anyway, the story continues. Lots and lots of things happen. I'm only got time to talk about a couple of them. So we're told that after a while he walks 50 metres and he turns round and he bows to the Bodhi tree. Isn't that gorgeous? Bows to this tree. There's a place at Burh Gaya called the Animisha, which is means unblinking. And apparently he stood there looking at this tree without blinking. I tried it. Couldn't do it for very long. My eyes started to get sore. But I felt I wanted to step in the Buddha's footsteps, you know. Anyway, he looks at that and he just feels this extraordinary gratitude to the tree. So why is that? Well, I suppose it's given him shelter. It's given him support. So there's a gratitude towards that. But also we realise that the Buddha did not see trees as inanimate objects. He saw, in the Pali Canon, you often get this evocation of almost like the spirits of trees and earth and rocks. And again, you can take them literally and imagine spirits and, you know, why not? There's more to life than what you see with a human eye. But also this sense that there's just life pulsing through the universe. The universe is an alive universe. Our planet is a live planet, even though we sometimes forget that. You know, so something for me and the Buddha feeling that gratitude that actually he's just grateful for life. And he's part of it in that moment. That's what you get, this sense of the Buddha just being there, pulsing with life and just love. You know, we're told that what he felt was he trembled with compassion. He just trembled. And he presumably could feel that trembling in every living being, in every object, in every being that was around him. The whole universe was vibrating with compassion. So it's also, in a way, a symbol of everybody that helped him to come to that point. So the tree is a symbol of life, and it's a and that's true in many cultures. It's still very true. I visit Mexico quite often, as Shradagita said, and when I first introduced the idea of the refuge tree there, which is a particular image that's used in Buddhist practice at times, where you imagine all the teachers of the past and the Buddhas kind of like on a tree, and then you allow a light to come from that tree. And I've introduced it in various places and people are like, yeah, tree. But in Mexico, people just loved it. They absolutely adored it from day one. And there's quite a lot of mythical resonance for people in that sense of like life, and there's a tree of life in some of the Mayan cultures. And it was just like really lovely to see that and get that kind of, that sort of resonance. Anyway, the thing that we can see here is that this newly enlightened Buddha, this figure, was being, was not only peaceful, he was grateful. He was a grateful Buddha. Some years ago, I was going to give a talk on Buddha Day, and I happened to see Bhante Sangharakshita the day before I gave this talk, and I said, oh, I haven't had a minute to think about it. What should I talk about, Bhante? Just tell me what to talk about. So he said, talk about gratitude. He said the Buddha was a grateful Buddha. So that was really lovely. But then he went on for about 15 or 20 minutes to tell me why he thought it was important to talk about gratitude. Because he wondered whether we have the right approach to gratitude in Western culture. And he contrasted it quite a lot with his experience of being in India, where people were very obviously grateful for the changes that Buddhism had made in their life. And that's still true to this day. And in some ways it's more marked, it's more obvious. But actually, I also feel great gratitude to having found the Dharma and the changes that it's made in my life. I mean, I say this quite seriously, and I know people say this sometimes, but I don't know that I'd still be alive if I hadn't found the Dharma. I actually mean that quite seriously. I was in a good road to self-destruction through, you know, the usual substances, enjoyable in their moment, but, you know, destructive. And I think it was finding the Dharma that just knocked me out of that kind of way of being, really. So I feel extraordinary gratitude to the Buddha and to Sangharakshita for the particular conditions that he set up. So Bhante said to me, you know, he thought, he wondered whether there was something in Western culture where pride got in the way of gratitude, where people don't want to show their gratitude because it kind of demeans them in some way, makes them feel lesser. Because if you're grateful to somebody, they've given you something. If they've given you something, then they've got something that you didn't have or something like that. I mean, he did go on about it quite a bit. So he said, go and tell them about that tomorrow. So I did, being a good girl. But it's interesting that gratitude is such... Bhante also said to me he wondered if that was why the Buddha sought out his five companions. So often it's seen as he thought, well, they were the nearest to enlightenment. They might be the people that would be most valuable to teach. Bhante said he wondered if it was also gratitude, because he first of all thinks of his old teachers, and he realises that they're dead, they've passed away, his old teachers. But Bhante wondered why maybe that was because he wanted to go back and say to them, look, what you gave me was part of the conditions that has allowed me to have this experience. So he saw that sort of chain. I thought that was quite interesting. Okay. So I also find quite a lot of gratitude as Shraddhagita said, I travel a lot and I often go to places where there's not such a concentration of all the members as there is at the LBC. There's probably virtually everywhere I travel to doesn't have as much of a concentration of all the members. I think the LBC must be the place with the most concentration of all the members outside India. Probably. Yeah, I would have thought so. So people, obviously, I'm sure people feel a lot of gratitude towards those order members, but sometimes when I travel, they've only got two or three order members running everything, and people are really grateful for that. And they're also incredibly grateful for free Buddhist audio and the Buddhist Centre online, because, you know, I meet people who, maybe their nearest Sangha's literally 3,000 miles away. And I went to Venezuela earlier this year, and the nearest centre to that's Mexico City, which took me 24 hours to get from one to the other. So that was flying. So, you know, I think it's easy to kind of forget that, but people in those sort of quite isolated situations feel enormous gratitude to what's offered. So the word that's been translated when we think of a grateful Buddha is katanyuta. And kata is what has been done. And anyuta is knowing or remembering. So it's a recollection of what's been done. Of course, you can't make people feel gratitude. You can't sort of say to somebody, you should be grateful. It doesn't kind of work like that, really. But it inspires me to think that the Buddha felt gratitude. I find that really inspiring and very sort of moving. The other thing is I'm one of the public preceptors, so I've ordained quite a lot of women over the years publicly, and they feel extraordinary gratitude, but it's not really me that they're feeling that gratitude towards. I mean, they might feel a bit of gratitude towards me, but it's something much bigger than that. It's me standing in a particular place and holding what's been given to me and kind of being a channel to pass that on. And I like to think of it like that. So I think gratitude's a connecting emotion. I think when we feel grateful, we're connecting to what's been given to us, but also it allows us to open up and give. I think that's very beautiful. So I think the Buddha's also expressing his gratitude for all the conditions that have brought him to that moment. Everything led to that, and everything leads out of it. It's a fulcrum moment in the Buddha's life. However, at this point, he looks around and he wonders if anybody will understand it. You might remember that part. I don't know if you've had that as a reading today. You often get that in Dharma Day rather than Buddha Day, because it's the point where he's got to make this decision as to whether he'll actually teach and share what he's discovered. So I'm going to read you a little bit about that. Now, while the Blessed One was alone, this thought arose in him. This law that I have attained is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. It is the most peaceful goal of all. It's for the wise to experience. But, he says, this generation relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see the truth, to see dependent arising. It is hard for this generation to still all formations. It is hard for this generation to experience the exhaustion of craving, the fading of their lust, and the cessation that is Nibbana. If I taught the law, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. you can kind of get the sense of what got you. I mean, you know, in very small ways, we probably all felt at times, oh, am I actually able to do this next thing or give this next talk or travel to this next place or something? Very minor kind of little way. So you can imagine the Buddha's just had this extraordinary experience of liberation. He's sitting there in this blissful emancipation and peace. He's filled with love and gratitude, and then he sort of thinks, oh God. Well, he probably doesn't think, oh God. It's unlikely, isn't it? And he thinks, oh Brahma or something like that, I don't know. He thinks, I'm going to be wearied by this. And it's quite interesting that this generation is so full of lust and whatever. And I suspect it's not changed that much. So I think you could probably still apply the same criteria. But anyway, something happens as he's thinking this. Brahma Sahampati, who kind of represents something or another. It's a bit hard to say what he represents, but let's say in this moment he represents a kind of call for help coming from humanity. So he recognises this thought and he comes and he says, no, no, Lord, the world will be lost. The world will be utterly lost. For the mind of the perfect one, accomplished, fully enlightened, is favouring inaction and not teaching the law. Please, Lord, the world will be lost. So this obviously has an effect when this figure who's just become enlightened and he hears Brahma Sahampati, and Brahma Sahampati says to him, there are creatures with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing the law. And then there's this beautiful image that we're given at this point, which will probably be familiar to most of you, of the pond of lotuses. And the Buddha sees humanity as this pond of lotuses, and he realises some are still very closed and are probably not ready to open. Whatever happens, they're probably not ready to open. But some are kind of a bit open. And if the sunshine of the Dharma shines upon them, then they might open more. And some are almost fully open, and all they need is just the law to be taught to them in the right and appropriate way, and then they can just open into perfect lotushood or perfect Buddhahood. So he does decide, thank the Buddha, he does decide to actually teach. And I really love that image of Brahma Sahampati coming. That's why I say he's a bit like a call for help, you know. He realises that this moment has arisen, this wonderful moment which has never arisen before in our time span and might never arise again and it might get lost. So he asks and he calls out for help. And sometimes we have to do that. We have to kind of open and be receptive to what the Buddha can offer us. So the Buddha decides to teach out of compassion. So the Buddha is also, he's not only a peaceful being, he's not only a grateful being, but he's a compassionate being. So there's the compassion there in the Buddha, and he does decide to teach. So I want to just tell you about another episode, and then we'll start to wind down. So the Buddha then looks around him and he thinks, I need to find somebody or something to revere. I need something where I can feel devotion. So even though we have this figure who's had this enlightenment experience and this amazing kind of bliss of emancipation, he realises he still wants to be devoted and offer himself to something. And we find this in a sutta called the Garava Sutta, which explains how he goes through this kind of space of... So I'm going to read you a bit from this. He says, the sutta says, when the Blessed One was newly self-awakened, he was staying at Uruvela on the bank of the river. While he was alone and in seclusion, this line of thinking arose in his awareness. One suffers if one dwells without reverence or deference. On what Brahman or contemplative can I dwell in dependence, honouring and respecting them? And then he goes through quite a long thing about what he looks for in a being that he can respect. And he just doesn't find anybody that can he can do that to. He says, in this world with its devas, in this generation with its contemplatives, its royalty, its common folk, I do not see a contemplative more consummate in knowledge and vision of release. Who can I honour and respect? And Brahmasahampati appears again. So thank goodness for him. Eh? He comes and he says, just before that, the Buddha actually realises, he says, what if I were to dwell in dependence upon the very Dharma to which I have fully awakened, honouring and respecting it? So he doesn't find another human being that he can feel that reverence to, but he does feel it to the law that he's discovered or he's reawakened to or he's experienced. So that's kind of quite interesting. And sometimes when you think, well, the Buddha revered the Dharma, it obviously doesn't mean the Dharma is his teaching, because he hasn't taught yet. He's still sitting under the Bodhi tree. But he needs something to respect and honour. That's the point of this sutta. No matter how accomplished we might be, it seems to be a human need to revere and honour something beyond ourselves. So Brahmasahampati appears and he says, yes, so it is, blessed one. All those of the past, all the awakened ones of the past, all the awakened ones yet to be, dwell in dependence upon the very Dharma. They honour and respect it. All who have dwelt will dwell, revering this true Dharma. This is the natural law. And he says, anyone who desires the good and aspires for greatness must respect the true Dharma. So it's interesting, kind of, the Buddha is the Buddha because of the Dharma. So in a way we're celebrating the Buddha's awakening, but you can't really separate it from the fact of what he discovered. But the main thing in that story or in that sutta is that the Buddha was also a worshipping Buddha. He wanted something or someone to worship and revere. And again, that's just something, it just goes again to that sense of gratitude and openness and open-heartedness. So he's awakened to this principle. He's awakened to this law by virtue of which he has gained enlightenment and by virtue of which any human being can do so. So one way of thinking about that is that he's kind of awakened to this principle of conditionality on a transcendent level. So he's kind of awakened to the fact that conditionality doesn't just work on a kind of physical, organic, chemical, biological level, but also works on the level of the Dharma itself. So I'm not going to go into great detail about that. Some of you will have come across a teaching called the Niyamas, the five Niyamas. Some of you probably haven't. All it's saying is that the law of conditionality works in different levels or governs different spheres of activity, but it's not only on the material. It's a helpful way of thinking, I find. I think it's quite a helpful way of thinking because it helps unpack what's meant by the idea of karma. Because again, karma is sometimes seen in a very linear way. Something bad happens, it must be your fault because you must have done something bad in the past. Whereas actually it's much more complex than that. We don't always know upon which level something's kind of being played out. But that law of conditionality, we studied it in a college meeting that I was in some years ago, and I remember somebody saying, it's interesting that we're able to cooperate with the law of physics. Why don't we cooperate with the law of the Dharma? You know, I just thought, oh yeah, that's really interesting, that's really true. It's like it's the same law. You know, so we expect an apple to fall from the tree. Why don't we expect to gain Buddhahood? You know, if the conditions are right, then the phenomenon arises. So if the conditions for the apple to fall are right, on that level of conditionality it works. If the conditions are right for awakening, why wouldn't we awaken? Duh. So And Sabuti, who many of you here will know, your president, he said in that meeting as well, and I wrote this down because I thought it was very good. He said, he's talking about this idea of conditionality on the kind of more dharmic or spiritual level. He says, there's a level of conditionality inherent in reality that unfolds. And you as an individual cannot command it, but you can cooperate with it. So that's the bit, you cannot command it. We are not in control in that sense, but we can cooperate with it. So what that means for me is we can cooperate with what's known as the bodhicitta. We can cooperate with what the desire to awaken, but not just for oneself, the desire to awaken so that all beings are offered that opportunity to awaken. And that's what that law is offering. We can live in ways that align ourselves with that reality, or we can live in ways that pull away from it. We can turn back, or we can keep opening up. And there's something mysterious and magical in that. There's something that's hard to define. And going back to that moment where the Buddha awakens under the Bodhi tree, of course you can give a talk about it, and probably all over the world today people are giving exactly these talks about it. And you can conceptualise it. But as I say, all these concepts are just fingers pointing to the moon. Then it's an experience, and it's an ineffable, magical, mysterious experience, and it's important to remember that. We can actually, it kind of defies definition, even though for 2,500 years people have struggled to define it. But I think the more we try and define it as well, we need to be careful we don't lose that taste, the taste of freedom, the taste of emancipation. We don't fix it, we don't make it too well explained. One way that Sangharakshita's talked about the bodhicitta, about this will to awaken and this desire to awaken for all beings, is he's talked about it as allowing ourselves to be part of a stream of non-egoistic energy. I really like that. In a way, rather than thinking about me becoming something, something about letting go into this stream of energy that's working for the good, as it were. So mystery might take us back to the Bodhi tree. So we're sitting here in London, many, many miles away, many, many generations away from that experience. But in a way, we're not so distant. That experience, we can think of it within time, and it happened whenever, 2,500 and something years ago. Or we can know that it happens outside time. It's happening at this very moment as we sit here. As we sit here in this room, seemingly so different, seemingly so far away, there is always that moment of awakening possible. We can align ourselves with that. We can allow ourselves to be touched, permeated by that mystery of the Buddha's enlightenment. So I want to read another bit from the Samyutta Nikaya, and then I'll close the talk. So long, brethren, as the moon and the sun have not arisen in the world, just so long there is no shining forth of a great light, no shining forth of great radiance. Gross darkness, the darkness of bewilderment, prevails. Neither night nor day is distinguishable, nor the month nor the half month, nor the seasons of the year. But when the moon and sun arise in the world, there is a shining forth of a great light, of great radiance. Darkness, the darkness of bewilderment, is no more. Then are distinguished the night and the day, the month and the half month, and the seasons of the year. Just so. So long as a Tathagata has not arisen, a Buddha supreme, there is no shining forth of great light, of great radiance. The darkness of bewilderment prevails. There is no proclaiming, no teaching, no setting up, no analyses, no making plain of the Four Noble Truths. But as soon as a Tathagata arises, all these things take place, and there is a proclaiming, a teaching, a showing forth. The sun and the moon shines, and great light shines forth, great radiance fills the world. Have any of you ever participated or seen a full eclipse of the sun in all its glory? It's an extraordinary experience. We do not very lucky in this part of the world, because usually when there's a full eclipse it's cloudy. But I did see one in Australia once, and it actually was quite an extraordinary experience. Suddenly just everything goes dark. It really does go dark, and it becomes very, very cold. Even just in that 4 minutes or whatever it is that it takes for the moon to fully eclipse the sun. And it's really spooky, actually. Somebody said they'd seen one. Somebody, yeah. I don't know if you had this experience, but all the birds stopped singing. And there was a dog. One of the people I was with had their dog, and it just went, it hid. Just like a minute or so before the eclipse actually started. It was the most extraordinary experience. You could really see why, for people who did not have the seemingly wonderful scientific evidence that we have for why that might be happening. Just suddenly the sun's gone out. The light's gone out. It's an extraordinary experience. And then it comes back. And you just watch this shadow move away, and you start to get the light coming back. And it's quite visceral. I found it a really visceral experience. I felt like it had this extraordinary effect. And I said, the birds stopped singing. That was the thing that freaked me out. You know, why did that happen? And something, I mean, obviously on a kind of physical level, that sense of our connectedness with the sun and what that offers us. But whenever I read that reading from the Samyutta Nikaya, I remember that experience. Just imagine a world without the sun and the moon. Nothing would grow. We would be chilled all the time. You know. And in the same way, a world without the Buddha's Dharma would be equally bare and barren and equally chilling. So it's wonderful when the light comes back. There's such a sense of relief. And it reminds me of what Brahma Sahampati said to the Buddha. The world would be utterly lost if it were not for this light of the Buddha's teaching being shown. So we've had various elements today in this hour. We had the wind at the beginning, and the wind in the Orkneys. We've had the sun, the moon, darkness and light. I just want to mention fire, because the world is on fire. This is what the Buddha taught. The Buddha said, there's a sutta in which the Buddha says, the world is on fire. My Dharma is the only thing that can appease this fire, that can quench this raging fire that's around the world. It's still burning. It has not been quenched. In many ways, I think the fires are burning even more brightly. I think greed, hatred and delusion still stalks the earth. Only now it stalks it in more scary manners, I would imagine. It stalks it in bigger manner. It's corporate. It's, you know, very, very hard to work against. Very hard to see how to put that fire out. And obviously there are all sorts of ways that we can work with that fire, whether they're political or social, and they're needed in many ways, whether they're to do with trying to live a more simple life, whether they're to do with trying to tread more lightly on the earth and not throw firewood on the fire. All those things are important. But I believe today, as we celebrate the Buddha's awakening, I really believe that that is the most important thing that we can offer the world. It's the thing that will truly quench the fires of greed, hatred and delusion. And all bad things that happen arise in dependence upon greed, hatred and delusion. However complex they might seem, that's what they come back down to. Greed, hatred and delusion. The three basic poisons. So today I want to just ask you to remember that earth-shattering moment when the Buddha sat under a tree and he became a peaceful being. How beautiful in a world that's not very peaceful. He was a grateful being. How lovely in a world where gratitude's not always seen as a high value or high virtue. And he was a compassionate being. He taught the Dharma, and we've all had the great good fortune to be touched by that in some way or another. And I really hope that it continues to touch you in deeper and deeper levels, so that we can continue to feel gratitude, we can continue to open the doors, whether it's the doors of the London Buddha Centre or the doors of our heart, to allow more and more people to be touched by the sun and the moon that is the Tathagata's great light. To all the awakened of the past, to all the awakened yet to be, to all the awakened that now are, my worship flows unceasingly. No other refuge than the wake. Refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory. Thank you.